original blend if your life depended on it. Which means that coffee can I just saw, he points to my backpack, isn't yours. Ergo, what's inside probably isn't either. His words are ice. They hit my gut first, then spread in all directions, filling my ears, elbows, knees, toes, the extremities of Mim, once a balmy 98.6, now a glacial effigy. Until this moment, the uncomfortable nearness of Poncho Man had been held at bay by other passengers and locks on doors. Now it's just us. There are no devices, no buffers. He stands there, taller than I remember, bulkier, blocking my way to the safety of my pack. I feel his eyes on me now, trailing from my hair, down my body, lingering in places they don't belong. And for the first time in a long time, I feel like a helpless girl. He steps closer. You are beautiful, you know. I'm shivering now, my bones and blood on full alarm. It's a primordial instinct, predator versus prey, passed down from 1,000 generations of women who, like me, feared the inevitable. We'd seen the footage of the hyena and the gazelle, and it always ended the same. So beautiful, he whispers. I close my good eye. In my mind, the bathroom dissolves into a reddish hue, the corners dimming like the vignette of an old arthouse film. The metamorphosis begins at Poncho Man's feet, his mismatched shoes bursting open at the toe, revealing short, sharp claws. His pants bulge at the knees and thighs, every pulsing muscle defined beneath the cheap fabric. His poncho stiffens, hardens, ripples into a spotted fur coat, matted and dirty. The blacks and oranges and browns of his mangy hide reflect the red light of the room, and behold, the metamorphosis of Poncho Man is complete, with one last addition, fangs. First one, then another, sprouting forth like two young oaks in fertile soil. Nothing will happen, he says, his voice thick. Nothing you don't want. And in that tone, I understand. I know. I'm not his first. Fuck you. Move. He reaches out, grips my arm just above the elbow. It's firm and painful.
Why would you say that to me?
Scream, Mary.
You're too good, he whispers, leaning his head closer.
I can smell his breath, every ounce as ashy and deceitful as I'd imagined.
I know you.
A scream had been boiling in my stomach and was about to take flight until...
I know your pain, he said.
My pain.
I'd like to be friends, Mim.
I am Mary Iris Malone, and I am not okay.
You want to be friends, don't you?
I am a collection of oddities. His grip is aggressive.
We could be more than friends, too.
A circus of neurons and electrons. His breath is warm. Ready? His lips are cold against mine. Set? His tongue? Go. Reaching down deep, my misplaced epiglottis locates a certain milk-soaked hockey puck. It gathers every ounce of the semi-digested beef and dairy, then, with pure force and accuracy, launches a vomit for the ages directly into Poncho Man's mouth. He chokes, gags, growls. Spinning, I unlock the door and exit the bathroom, breathing in the freedom of the rarely savvy gazelle. September 2, noon. Dear Isabel, a quick note. I don't think a vivid imagination is all it's cracked up to be. I'm quite certain you have one, but if not, thank the gods of born with gifts and move on. However, if you're cursed as I am with a love of storytelling and adventures in galaxies far, far away, and mythical creatures from fictional lands who are more real to you than actual people with blood and bones, which is to say, people who exist, well, let me be the first to pass on my condolences. Because life is rarely what you imagined it would be. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone, Storytelling Lackey.
Nashville, Tennessee. 526 miles to go. Chapter 12. Anomalies. In sixth grade advanced English, my teacher presented a challenging assignment. Find a single word to best describe you, then write a paper as to why. During the 2 weeks leading up to the paper's due date, I pored over the dictionary each night, searching for that one word which might perfectly define Mim Malone. In the end, I chose the word anomaly. I had it down to that or cheeky, and by my reckoning, it would be far easier to define my many moods with a word whose very definition was a person or thing that couldn't be defined by any one thing. This, I thought, was irrefutable logic at its finest. I remember the last paragraph of that paper like it was yesterday. In summary, I am 110% anomaly, plus maybe 33% independent spirit, and 7% free-thinking genius. My sum total is 150%, but as a living, breathing anomaly, this is to be expected. Boom. Back then, I closed all my papers with boom. It added a certain profound punctuation, a little high class among the meandering bourgeois. If I remember correctly, I received a C-. But even today, inasmuch as an anomaly is a thing that deviates from what is standard, normal, or expected, I can think of no more appropriate word to describe myself. I hate lakes, but love the ocean. I hate ketchup, but love everything else a tomato makes. I would like to read a book and go to a fucking party. I want it all, baby. And pulling into the Nashville Greyhound station, I am reminded of how much I hate country music. But blimey, I just can't get enough Johnny Cash, the grandfather of that very genre. And, of course, Elvis, but I don't really count him as country. Those were Mom's two favorite musicians. We used to sit on her old college couch in the garage and listen straight through Man in Black or Heartbreak Hotel. Vinyl, of course, because there really is no other way to listen to music. Just soaking in the scratched-up honesty of those two baritones, because damn it all, they'd lived life. And if anyone had a personal understanding of the pain of which they sang, it was Cash and Presley. At least that's what Mom said. As I grew up, my taste changed, but when I think about it, even the music I listen to now has a certain tragic honesty to it. Bon Iver, Elliott Smith, Arcade Fire, artists whose music demands not to be liked, but to be believed. And I do. I believe them. Carl pulls the bus into the station and grabs the mic. "Okay, folks, welcome to Nashville. If this is your final destination..." He smiles, and I wonder if those chipped teeth are courtesy of the accident. "Well, you made it. If not, you done missed your connecting bus. Just go on up to the ticket desk, they'll set you up. And don't forget your vouchers. Lord knows you earned them." He clears his throat, continues. "As a Greyhound employee, I apologize for the incident outside Memphis and hope it don't discourage you from choosing Greyhound in the future. As a human being, I apologize for the incident outside Memphis. I wouldn't blame you one damn bit if you never rode another Greyhound again. Now get the hell off my bus." I make it a general rule not to clap for anyone. Seeing as how few concerts and sporting events I attend, it's never really been an issue. But after Carl's rousing oration, this bus is going wild, and I find myself slapping my palms together in spite of my rule. I grab my backpack from the overhead bin and slide into the aisle, keeping my good eye on Poncho Man. After, let's call it, the incident of the bile in the restroom, I made two important decisions. Number one, I would lay off the X-Files reruns, as my capacity for monstrous imaginings has had free rein for long enough. And number two, I would not turn him in. The X-Files thing I decided in about 3 seconds. The not turning in a perverted troll of a loafer-strutting poncho-wearing motherfucker I thought about the rest of the way to Nashville. And while nothing would give me more pleasure than handing his ass over to the cops, getting to Cleveland is an absolute non-negotiable. Period. I say something about the incident of the bile in the restroom, and that's that. I'd be dragged back to Mosquito Land, a traitor among the blood-sucking scavengers. On top of my not being in Cleveland for Mom during her hour of need,
Poncho Man knows about my Hills Brothers can. Kathy would press charges, I'd be arrested for theft, and instead of spending Labor Day with Mom, I'd spend it in juvie. Bottom line, I can't be certain Poncho Man will strike again. But turn him in, and I can be certain my objective is done for. So yes, it sucks. But honestly, I can't figure a way around it. Poncho Man is at the front of the line. I watch him nod to Carl, then step down off the bus. Now, I just need to get my ticket, get lost in a crowd, and pray that's the end of it. He goes one way, I go another, and ne'er the two shall meet. Carl is sitting in the driver's seat, saying goodbye to everyone as they pass. Whatever questions I had at the beginning of my trip pertaining to this guy's true Carl nature have been answered, and then some. He's about as Carl as they come. I smile at him, and even get ready to shake his hand, which requires serious preparation on my part, when he grabs me by the shoulder. He leans in, his eyes full of familiar mischief, and whispers, "Good luck, Missy." Then, releasing his grip, he smiles and winks, and suddenly I know exactly who he reminds me of. And it's not Samuel L. Jackson. Once off the bus, I locate the nearest bench and pull out my journal. September 2, afternoon. Dear Isabel, let's pull back another layer of the giant onion of my reasoning, shall we? Reggie is reason number 6. He always stood on the same corner back in Ashland. Knee-high combat boots, frazzled hair, dirty face, winning smile. Mom said the reason Reggie stood on the same corner, Samaritan and Highway 511 if you want specifics, was that it was the closest traffic light to the downtown shelter. I had soccer at the YMCA on Wednesdays after school, more unwanted extracurriculars. From Taft Elementary to the Y, it was a straight shot down Claremont to East Main, a drive which should have taken no more than 5 minutes. But we never went that way. Instead, Mom, her eyes gleaming with the young fun now, took Smith Road to Samaritan Avenue, then 511 up to East Main. It added an extra 10 minutes, but she didn't care. Every Wednesday, without fail, Mom rolled down her window at the corner of Samaritan and 511 and exchanged $3 for a smile and a God bless from Reggie. One Saturday, while shopping for a new something or other, Dad happened to be in the car with us when we came to that exact corner. Dad had never met Reggie before, and as far as I knew, he didn't know about my mom's generosity toward the homeless. As we pulled up, Mom reached for the window down button, but before she could press it, Dad started in on what a lazy bunch the homeless were, being the dregs of society and whatnot. "He could get a job," Dad said, casually throwing a thumb in Reggie's direction, "if he wasn't such a lazy drunk." Mom looked right at Dad and didn't say a word, just calmly rolled down the window. Reggie walked up. "Howdy, Eve. Mighty fine morning." Still looking at Dad, my mom responded, "Indeed it is, Reggie. Here you go." I was concerned about what Dad would say once that window was rolled back up. I guess Reggie could feel the tension because after taking the cash, he looked right at me in the back seat and winked, his eyes full of a comforting sort of mischief. Then, looking back at my mom, he gave a two-fingered salute. This salute had always been accompanied by a God bless. But this time Reggie said, "Good luck, Miss Evie." My mom rolled the window up, never once taking her eyes off Dad. "Good luck to you," she said. She could be stone cold when she wanted to be. Later, just before bed, I asked her if Dad was mad that she gave $3 to Reggie. She said no, but I knew better. I asked if Dad was right, if Reggie was nothing but a lazy drunk. Mom said some homeless folk were like that, but she didn't think Reggie was one of them. She said even if he were, she would still give him $3. She said it wasn't her job to pick which ones were genuinely starving and which ones were faking it. "Help is help to anyone, Mary, even if they don't know they're asking for it." I said that made a whole lot of sense, because it did, and it still does. Here's the thing is, my mom needs help right now, and I know it, even if she doesn't. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone,
Samaritan Avenue Vagabond. Chapter 13. Everything sounds better on vinyl.
Excuse me, do you have the time?
I look up from my journal and almost keel over. The stranger has a unibrow, a bushy mustache, severe acne, 3-inch-thick glasses, and overly chapped lips. So many things. I vomit a little, force it back down. Sorry, I'm just unsure which facial feature to avoid. I blink, then gulp, then use my words. Yes, I say, pulling my cell phone out of my bag. Almost one. He stomps off, leaving me to stare at my phone. 28 missed calls. 26 from Kathy. 2 from Dad. Attaboy. A waste bin sits by my bench, beckoning. I could just throw the stupid thing away, be rid of Stevie Wonder and his sonic detritus once and for all. Reluctantly, I stuff the phone in my bag, along with my stick figure journal, then march over to the ticket counter and hand the lady my voucher.
You traveling alone?
She whines, chomping on gum. I'm ready this time, armed with a new strategy.
Yes, ma'am.
My dad is sending me up to Cleveland to live with my mom, see? They got divorced earlier this year, a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions, and it pretty much devastated me to the point of murdering myself. But really, how does one go about it? The lady continues chewing, wholly unimpressed.
I know, I say, nodding, smiling. And before you say it, yes, I thought about sleeping pills, but how many do you take?
My luck, I'd take just enough to do some serious damage, but not quite enough to do the trick, you know? Doomed to roam the streets of Cleveland, some tragic kid with half a brain, everyone whispering as I pass, there's the girl who failed at living and dying. So yeah, I'll pass on pills, but the car in the garage thing, that sounds promising, don't you think?
She pops a bubble the size of a grapefruit, takes my voucher, hands me my ticket.
Number 1677 to Cleveland, she says. Departs at 1:32. You got 30 minutes, kid.
Thanks, I say, taking the ticket. You're a real treat.
Outside, the downtown area is abuzz with traffic and music. Tourists young and old swarm into boot parlors, record stores, and vintage guitar shops, trying to get a jump on Labor Day deals. Live bands are set up in a dozen storefront windows like mannequins, advertising twang instead of tweed. And the honky-tonks, my God, the honky-tonks. Until now, I'd assumed a honky-tonk was a quiet bar full of strange people I would never want to talk to. In reality, they're obnoxiously loud bars full of strange people I would never want to talk to. I pass one with a band blaring something about a badonky-donk, which I can only assume is the official honky-tonk national anthem. I'm already jealous of myself 5 minutes ago, because you can't unknow a honky-tonk. Across the street, a life-size statue of Elvis beckons, and suddenly, nothing else matters. I grip my backpack and hustle over for a closer look. It's sort of sad, actually, though not altogether unrealistic. The hair looks about right, anyway, from his later days. That's when it occurs to me. Mom would love this. However imperfect this trip has been thus far, I've now stopped in both Graceland and Nashville, two cities synonymous with cash and the king. This is a good sign. I take another look around and hook my thumbs in my pockets. I whistle, I smile, I throw on my idiot face. Give me your hats, your honky-tonks, your boots, your bedonky-donks. I am Mary Iris Malone, tourist extraordinaire.
Behind the statue is a store called Hat Shop, S-H-O-P-P-E. Summoning every ounce of Malone's stick-to-itiveness, I walk inside. The floors are wooden, the people are loud, the music is I don't know what. The first hat in reach has black and white spots. I pick it up and, just out of curiosity, inspect the tag on the inside. Made with authentic cowhide. Well, that's good and gross. I take a deep breath. I put it on. I look at myself in the mirror. I set it down. I walk out. As far as I'm concerned, it never happened. I spend the next 90 seconds in the adjacent boot shop, S-H-O-P-P-E, then over 10 minutes in a record shop. S-H-O-P, for real. It's not hard. Actually, it's two letters easier. Pre-loved vinyl is a weakness I inherited from my mother, one I'm quite proud of. I had a record player long before my classmates decided it was cool. And when they finally came around, I didn't rub this in. Everything sounds better on vinyl. It's not a trend. It's a fact. I almost purchase a near-mint copy of Remain in Light by the Talking Heads, but talk myself out of it. There's no telling what sort of expenses I might encounter between here and Cleveland. Speaking of which, what little sustenance may have been garnered from a hockey-pucked burger, I'd put to far greater use during the incident of the bile in the restroom. Which is to say, I'm starving. At a nearby taco stand, I order 3 carnitas with extra cilantro, then wolf them down on the walk back to the Greyhound station. Once there, I keep my head down, on the off chance Poncho Man is still around, and step in line for the 1677 at Gate B. After a few minutes, the line inches forward. I stick my hands in my jeans pocket and grip Mom's lipstick. Shit. I should have bought that Talking Heads record. She would have loved it. September 2, 1:32 p.m. Dear Isabel, my mother was the greatest alarm clock of all time. Every morning, without fail, she threw back the curtains to let the sun in, and always she said the same thing. Have a vision, Mary, unclouded by fear. Just like that. It was so wonderful. Of course, this idea of unclouded vision would come to mean another thing entirely after the great blinding eclipse, but that's neither here nor there. The quote was an old Cherokee proverb, one that her mom told her, and hers before that, and so on and so forth, all the way back to the original Cherokee woman who coined the phrase. Mom's father was British, but her mother was part Cherokee, which is, I think, a perfect example of history getting the last laugh. I was so proud of this heritage is, do you know what I did? I started lying about the degree of Cherokee blood in my veins. I was something like 1/16, but honestly, who wasn't, right? So I claimed 1/4. It just sounded more legit. I was young, still in middle school, so I went with it the way kids that age do. The more admiration this garnered from teachers and friends, the closer I felt to my ancient ancestry, my kinswomen, my tribe. But the truth will out, as they say. In my case, this outing took on the sound of my mother's unending laughter in the face of my principal when he told her the school was going to present me with a plaque of merit at the next pep rally, the Native American Achievement Award. Needless to say, I never received the award. But even today, there are times, most notably when I wear my war paint, when I really feel that Cherokee blood coursing through my veins, no matter its percentage of purity. So from whatever minutiae of my heart that pumps authentic Cherokee blood, I pass this phrase along to you. Have a vision, unclouded by fear. Not sure what made me think of all this Cherokee stuff. Maybe it's the plethora of cowboy hats and boots I've seen today. Politically correct? Probably not. But I'm 1/16th Cherokee, so suck it. Anyway, I just remembered there's a bag of chips in my backpack, so I'm gonna put the kibosh on this note with another one of my mother's Cherokee proverbs. When you were born, you cried while the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries while you rejoice. Funny, as a child, I never knew whether to laugh or cry when Mom said that. But now I know the truth. You can laugh and cry, Iz, because they're basically the same thing. Signing off, Chiefess Iris Malone. I shut my journal and slide the lock to unoccupied. This new bus is far from packed, which means I get my own row again. Considering the rare collection of individuals on board, the having my own row thing could not be of greater import. It's a freak show, really. Reminiscent of my time in the Deep South. Mosquito land. The thorn in my side.
the rock in my shoe, the poison in my wine. Unfortunately, it appears the thorn, the rock, and the poison have followed my path north. 29B is breastfeeding. 26A has fallen asleep while snacking on a box of Cheez-Its. 24B is playing Battleship with 24A, complete with warlike sound effects. 21D is wearing Bugs Bunny slippers and a t-shirt that says, "No one cares about your blog." 19A and B must be mother and daughter, a beautiful Hispanic duo. They're asleep on each other, and it's actually kind of adorable. So, okay, they're fine. And, blimey, 17C is good looking. How did I not notice him before? I pass him on my left, careful not to stare. He looks like that guy in Across the Universe. Gah, what is his name? Suddenly, my beloved Goodwill shoes and favorite red hoodie seem an odd choice. Certainly, they aren't my most flattering articles of clothing. My jeans are fine, I suppose, albeit a little bloody at the knee. But yeah, the hoodie. I should have put on Mom's old Zeppelin tee this morning, tight in all the right places. At the very least, I could have... What the hell? Having reached my seat, I remain standing, frozen to the spot. A paper bag, brown, thin, square, is propped next to my backpack. I sit down, pick up the bag, and immediately know what's inside. I've purchased enough vinyl to know a record when I'm holding one. Talking Heads Remain in Light. Near mint condition. Every ounce of blood rushes to my face as this sets in. I raise my head just enough to peer over the top of the seat in front of me. And there he is. The perverted troll of a loafer-strutting, poncho-wearing motherfucker himself, six rows up, smiling like a hyena. In the movie of my life, I crack the record in two, open the window, and toss the pieces to the side of the highway. But as the Greyhound windows don't open, I have to settle for the first part. It's a shame because Mom loves all things David Byrne, but I won't have any piece of poncho man sully our time together. I pull the vinyl from the sleeve and crack it in two. The hyena isn't smiling now. Collapsing in my seat, I breathe, think, adjust. It's possible he's not following me. We probably just have similar roots. So what, then? I avoid going to the bathroom? Spend the rest of the ride looking over my shoulder? It's not too late to turn him in, though I would still be sacrificing my objective. Think, Malone. I toss the remains of the record in the seat next to me. Outside, the afternoon sky passes in a blur. I stare at it with my good eye and wonder, I have money. I have brains. I have a font of intuition. So intuit already. I pull out the itinerary that came with my ticket. Next official stop, Cincinnati. Options. I could get a cab, or hitchhike. Boom. Yes. What better way to get to Mom, she of the European Hitchhikers Guild? Ditch the bus. I pull the bag of chips from my backpack. They're warm and crisp, and by the time I open the bag, I've made up my mind. I want out. Of all of it. The random stops, the strange smells, the uncomfortable nearness of Poncho Man. I'll ditch the bus in Cincinnati. At least I'll be in the right state. Really, there's no downside except... Munching, I twist in my seat and peer around the edge. Crunch. 17C is three rows behind me, across the aisle, pressing a digital camera against his window. Crunch. He's older than me, probably early 20s, so it's not completely out of the question. Us getting married and traveling the world over, I mean. Right now, a 5-year difference might seem like a lot, but once he's 54 and I'm 49, well, shoot, that's nothing. Crunch. There's a quality about him, something like a movie star, but not quite. Like he could be Hollywood if it weren't for his humanitarian efforts, or his volunteer work, or his clean conscience, no doubt filled to the brim with truth, integrity, and a heart for the homeless. Crunch. He has longish brown hair and beautiful dark green eyes.
His stubbly beard isn't preteenish, it's, I don't know what. Rugged, yes, but not only. It's the stuff of hunters and builders and carpenters. It suggests outdoorsy intelligence. It's desert fucking island stubble is what it is. Crunch. A navy zip-up Patagonia fits perfectly wrapped around his upper torso like a, well, like something. His shoulders aren't broad, nor are they narrow. His jeans aren't skinny, nor are they loose. His boots aren't clean, nor are they dirty. 17C is just the right amount of himself. He is my perfect anomaly. Crunch. Apparently done taking pictures, he dismantles his camera, stows it under his seat, and pulls out a book. Between the hair, boots, jacket, and camera, he's really working the Pacific Northwest pre-hipster post-grunge thing, which I have to say I just love. Squinting, I try to see what book he's reading, though I don't suppose it would really... Shit. I jerk back in my seat. Did he see me? I think he saw me. Crunch. I need to keep my head in the game anyway. Crunch. Those eyes. If I'm going to see this new plan through. Crunch. That hair. We'll be in Cincinnati before you know it. Crunch. 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 I tip the bag of crumbs, aiming for my mouth, but hitting my hair and face instead. Thank God for the high seat backs. Independence, Kentucky. 278 miles to go. Chapter 14. Grammatical Shenanigans.
How many scoops do you want?
I stare through the glass at the dozen or so tubs of ice cream. How many can I have?
As many as you want.
Ha, right, okay. Well, here's the thing. I look at her name tag. Glenda. How many scoops I want might kill me, like actually kill me dead. Plus, I don't really feel like breaking records in this category. So, what's the current scoop record again?
Glenda sighs. 7.
Jackpot. Even though Cincinnati is something like 20 minutes away, our driver, whose name I've already forgotten but I assure you is the very opposite of Carl, insisted on stopping for pie. That's right, pie. Over the microphone, he'd announced that Jane's Diner had the best pie this side of the mighty Mississippi, and that he'd be a monkey's uncle if he was going to pass right by without helping himself to a slice. And that if we knew what was good for us, we'd help ourselves to a slice, too, and that we'd surely be thanking him later. Naturally, I decided never to eat pie again. As luck would have it, across the street from Jane's was this little place called, I kid you not, Ace's Dairy Dip Mart Stop Plus. I could not resist. And really, why would I want to? Glenda scoops, I pay, and a few minutes later, I carry my double chocolate espresso chip raspberry mint caramel lemon waffle cone across the street, the happiest girl this side of the mighty effing Pacific. A patrol car is flashing lights in the parking lot of Jane's Diner. There doesn't seem to be any commotion, but a cop is giving someone a stern talking to in the back seat. I lean against the bus and watch my fellow passengers through the window of Jane's Diner. It's one of those trailers without wheels, which I never really understood. Removing a vehicle's wheels in order to make it a stationary venue makes about as much sense as buying a bed, then using the wood to make a chair. But this isn't what bugs me most about Jane's Diner. What bugs me most is the sign on the front door. Quote, come on in, end quote, we're open. I chuckle mid-lick. People just can't help themselves when it comes to quotation marks, as if they're completely paralyzed by this particular punctuation. I guess it's really not that big of a deal, but it does seem to be a widespread brand of easily avoidable buffoonery. Through the window, I scan the crowd for Poncho Man, but I don't see him anywhere. No matter. In less than an hour, it's adios anyway.
I done know that, Purge. You ain't listening.
A couple wearing matching cowboy hats exits Jane's Diner, their voices covering serious ground.
I am too, darling, but if and you can't get her done here in Independence, you can't get her done nowheres.
I choke on a tart lick of lemon.
Ah, shit, Farper, just shut up and listen for a sec.
Excuse me, I interrupt. Did you say independence? They look at me as if they'd just as soon shoot me. A wad of tobacco comes flying out of the man's mouth, landing inches from my precious high tops. Enchanté, Purge.
So what if we did?
Oh my God, they did. I'm here. Home of Ahab, Arlene's nephew, the champion swimmer turned gas station tycoon. Across the overpass, there are at least 4 gas stations. It could be any one of them.
Listen, says the one called Purge. This here is one of the great frontier towns in all America. I'll kiss a monkey's ass for I'll listen to you denigrating independence.
I take a second to appreciate the fact that this man can't pronounce America, but knows the word denigrate. The woman sticks her right hand in her vest pocket, and for a minute, I'm legitimately afraid she's packing heat. Instead of a gun, she pulls out a flask, takes a long swig, passes it to Purge.
Of course not, sir. I would never. Independence seems like a charming little town.
The land of autonomy.
You just, says Purge, eyeballing me.
From the relative comfort of my bus seat, the decision to ditch the Greyhound had been a fairly easy one. The prospect of hitchhiking to Cleveland sounded downright adventurous. But gazing around rural Kentucky, the realities of my plan settle in my stomach like a brick.
The hell's wrong with her, Purge? Whispers the woman.
Purge shakes his head. I toss the rest of my ice cream cone on the ground and start toward the bus door. Thanks, guys. Keep it classy. Hopping up the steps, I picture Arlene, a grande dame from the old school, mistress of geriatric panache and my friend, clutching that wooden box for dear life. And a dear life it was. Now I have the opportunity to deliver that box, to finish what she started, to honor her dear life. I have the chance to complete Arlene's objective. And I'll be damned if I'm not going to take it. I grab my backpack from the overhead compartment and start back down the aisle when a voice stops me on a dime.
You skipping out?
At the top of the stairs, I turn and see 17C, heart be still, propped on his knees in a seat toward the back of the otherwise empty bus. He's holding his camera next to the window. It's obvious I've interrupted some kind of photo shoot. What? I whisper, suddenly wondering what the hell I'd been thinking, cutting my own hair.
I asked if you were skipping out, he said.
I step into the aisle, pushing my bangs out of my eyes. It's a simple question, requiring a simple answer, but for the moment, my tongue seems vacuum-sealed to the roof of my mouth. I'm pretty certain I need a nose job and my armpits itch, which... what the hell? Pull it together, Malone. I nod and smile, and he nods and sort of half-smiles, and oh God, if that's only half the smile, I can't imagine the whole one. He has a black eye, which I hadn't noticed before. Even with the shiner, though, the eyes are a warm green. Bright, stunning, unforgettable. His eyebrows are thick. Not bushy, just thick, as if they were drawn using the broad side of a marker.
Well, good luck, he says.
Outside, the cop car is in his direct line of vision. He follows my eyes, then blushes and puts the cap back on the lens.
Yeah, I mutter. Good luck to you, too.
He leans back in his chair, closes his eyes, and whispers, Thanks. Then, almost in a breath, I'm gonna need it. In the movie of my life, I have scenes and dialogue rather than experiences and discussions. Instead of friends, a cast. Instead of places, a setting. At this moment, a definite movie moment. I blink in slow motion. The camera zooms in on my eyes as I drink in the enigmatic 17C. The audience sits in silent wonder, a combination of hope, sadness, and wistful longing for romance stirring in their bellies. Alas, the girl is leaving, and the boy is staying, and 'twas always thus. The likelihood of their stories intertwining again doesn't make for a very believable plot. Though I suppose that depends on a person's definition of believable. From 1,000 metaphorical miles away, a sweet voice rings in my ears.
You'd be surprised what I believe these days,
channeling the faith of Arlene, and with her precious wooden box strapped to my back, I step off the bus. More than anything, I want to be with Mom right now. Whatever her sickness is, she needs me desperately, and I know this. But all my favorite movies have one thing in common. A singular moment in which you can feel the director telling his character's story as well as his own. It is beautiful, poignant, and appallingly rare. I don't know what's in this box, but I am part of its story, as it is part of mine. Making my way back across the street, I consider the role of 17C in my movie. It's a hard sell, our characters meeting again, but I won't count it out just yet, because there's nothing I hate more than a predictable ending. Chapter 15. Effing Attitude.
Going for number 8?
I smile, but it fools no one.
Good one, Glenda. Seriously, though, how have you been?
How have you been? My problem is I never know what to say to people. I clear my throat and press on.
I was wondering if you could tell me where I might find a gas station owned by a guy named Ahab.
Glenda leans behind the counter, reappears with a spoon.
I know it's a strange question, I say, but it's important.
Dipping her spoon into a vat of cookie dough ice cream, she comes up with a generous scoop. I give her a second, thinking she's thinking. She's not, as it turns out. What she's doing is eating the ice cream with orgasmic vigor. I know I shouldn't, but I can't help myself.
It's pretty good, yeah?
Glenda smacks her lips.
I don't know anyone by that name. Unless you're talking about Moby Dick.
I imagine myself scrambling over the vat of cookie dough, grabbing her by those split ends and shoving her face in the tub of ice cream. It could be my thing, what I'm known for. A mim swirly. Staring at Glenda's self-satisfied expression, I choose to murder her with kindness instead. I raise both hands and put air quotes around my next three words.
Thank you, Glenda.
Ace's Dairy Dip Mart Stop Plus is within walking distance of all four gas stations. They're in a little cluster on the other side of the overpass, my best bet at finding Ahab. I grip my backpack and walk across the bridge. Every time a car zooms underneath, the whole thing wobbles a few inches, and here are the things I imagine. The road crumbling under my feet, the bridge caving in as I fall to the highway below, a chunk of cement crushing my head, a monstrous cloud of debris like the videos from 9/11. WTF, Malone. I need to cheer the hell up. I should do whatever happy people do when they're being happy. I try whistling. Nick Drake. Impossible, as it turns out. I might as well be tap dancing to the theme from Jaws. Come to think of it, maybe that's why I've always thought Nick and I would have gotten along so well. I bet he had zero patience for the kind of thing where someone just oozed their good mood all over the place. R.I.P., Nick. R.I.P. For the rest of the walk, I strike the perfect balance between happy and miserable, which is surprisingly a narrow margin. The nearest gas station has a sign out front that's so faded I can't tell if it's a BP or a Shell or a Marathon or what. Probably something preposterous like Ed's Place. God, I bet that's exactly what this is. Like a Saharan cactus, a dusty payphone stands forgotten in the corner of the parking lot, which reminds me of my cell phone, which reminds me of Stevie Wonder, which reminds me of Kathy, which reminds me of Dad. They're probably worried. They're probably sort of freaking out by now. F 'em. The door jangles as I push it open.
Afternoon, says man behind the counter.
I almost drop my backpack when I see his name tag. Hi, I'm Ed, and I'm here to help you. My brain explodes into a thousand pieces of incredulity. It's an Ed. In quotes. Congratulations, universe. You win. I turn on my heels and walk out of the gas station. I don't even care if that was Ahab's boyfriend or not. Henceforth, I have a new policy, and it is unflinchingly rigid. No Eds, no mo. The next gas station is owned by a guy named Morris, who is pretty frowny and tragic. Luckily, he answers my questions in short yeps and nahs.
and I don't have to spend any more time with him than is absolutely necessary. The third gas station is owned by some guy who's not Ahab. The last station is an actual shell, and the young girl behind the counter blows a giant bubble with her gum and offers me free cigarettes. Sometimes I think Shell might be taking over the world, and I just can't believe everyone is okay with this. I mean, pretty soon we're going to have gum-blowing girls offering free cigarettes to underage kids on every street corner in America. And I would like to state for the record, I am not okay with this. Somehow I end up under the very bridge I'd envisaged collapsing, watching my Greyhound speed by, northbound sans mim. I raise a hand as it passes, not in farewell, but in good riddance. And that, as they say, is that. Alone in independence. How terribly fitting. I pull out Mom's lipstick, twirl it in my fingers, and try to think what to do next. Maybe it's the unseasonably warm weather or the sinking realization that I just waved goodbye to 17C forever and ever, or the residue of Glenda's third-rate spirit, or the shortage of sound sleep I got at last night's motel. But I'm feeling decidedly insurgent and exhausted. All these Eds and Morrises and guys who aren't Ahab and young girls who blow gum and offer free cigarettes and unending disappointments, disenchantments, and 100 other disses have just drained me. So F it. I'm going to sit right here and only for a minute. I pull my knees up, rest my forehead between them, and stare at the ground. The cracks on the pavement come together in the shape of a rabbit. The twitchy nose, the long feet, the fluffy tail. It's all there. How strange. Chapter 16. White Rabbit.
Mim, why don't you have a seat?
Why don't you drop dead? Mary, sit. Your mother, Kathy, and I have something to tell you. Oh my shit, Dad, really? God, Mim, language. That woman is not my mother, and I'm not Mary. Not to you.
We have news. Would you like to hear it or not?
Hey, hey, I'm Walt. I jolt awake. The rabbit is still there, but a different shade. I rub my eyes, and a blurry pair of green Converse comes into focus. Hey, hey, I'm Walt. On either side of the highway, the shadows of the trees are longer. Traffic is heavier, slower, rush hour. I curse, stand up, and brush the street off my jeans. My bandaged leg is throbbing from the awkward position of my impromptu nap. Hey, hey, I'm Walt. The owner of the Chucks is about my height, my age, and for all I know, he's been standing here introducing himself all afternoon. His hair, poking out beneath an old Chicago Cubs baseball cap, isn't so much long as it is scraggly and stringy, like a stray mutt's. He's holding a Rubik's Cube in one hand and an almost empty 20-ounce Mountain Dew in the other. Before I can introduce myself, he throws his head back and chugs the last of the soda. With authority. My smile takes on a life of its own. Hey, Walt. I'm Mim. Nodding, he holds out a dewy hand. I shake it, and suddenly space and time shift. It's the summer before third grade. A new family has just moved in across the street. They have a boy, Ricky, about my age. We have the same bike, a kick-ass neon Schwinn, qualification enough to become fast friends. His speech is slurred and his mind slow, but he walks fast. Every step is intentional, quick-footed. As if he's always late for something. We hang out that whole summer, and things are good. And then school starts. Ty Zarnstorf, in front of everyone on the playground, says, Hey, Mim, if you love Ricky the retard so much, why don't you marry him? Everyone laughs. I'm not sure why, but I know enough to know it's not nice. So I punch Ty, breaking his nose and earning a one-day suspension. That night at dinner, I ask Mom what retarded means and if Ricky is a retard. She says, Retard is a mean word used by mean people. Ricky has what is called Down syndrome, and all it means is that he's a little slower than most.
A few minutes later, Dad goes to the bathroom. Mom takes a bite, clears her throat.
There are worse fates than being slow-witted, she says.
You broke that other kid's nose, right? The one who made fun of Ricky?
I say, yes, ma'am, I did.
Good, she says, taking another bite.
Hey, hey, you okay?
I am pulled back to reality by a kid currently stuffing the pocket of his jeans with an empty Mountain Dew bottle. Exactly the sort of thing Ricky might do.
You do the do, Walt?
He laughs a laugh for the ages, and my young heart damn near melts all over the side of the road.
What are you doing?
He asks, shifting focus to his Rubik's Cube.
What do you mean?
I mean, what are you doing?
I might just never stop smiling.
Well, I'm taking an accidental nap under a highway overpass, I guess.
No,
he says, hell-bent on solving the cube.
I mean as a part of big things.
Walt's statement is vague at best, gibberish at worst. But here's the thing. I understand exactly what he means. I'm trying to get to Cleveland, I say. It's not a lie, but it certainly doesn't answer the spirit of the question. By Labor Day, if possible.
Why?
Traffic is pretty much at a standstill under this bridge. If I'm gonna do this, now's the time. I begin sizing up drivers for the best prospective ride, by which I mean someone who doesn't look like an axe murderer.
Reasons are hard, man.
Why?
He asks again. I hate leaving this kid by the side of the road, but surely he has someone with him.
Walt, are you with a friend or your mom or something?
No. She's with the white pillows. In the casket.
I turn toward him. He looks serious enough.
Hey, look!
He says, holding up his Rubik's Cube, now complete.
All done. Done good. Good and done.
Walt, where do you live?
He throws his head back, messes up the cube as if he doesn't trust himself not to peek.
New Chicago, he says. Do you like shiny things? I have lots of shiny there. And a pool.
He looks me up and down.
You're a pretty dirty person right now. You could use a pool. Also, there's ham.
I am Mary Iris Malone, and I am 100% intrigued.
You wanna come with me? Asks Walt.
I push my bangs out of my eyes and slide my backpack on. Mere feet away, traffic inches along, luring me with a steady hum of engines. I don't think I can, buddy. I'd like to, but... Without a word, the kid tears up, turns, and walks away. Watching him go, I can't explain the why, but I know the what. I feel like a sack of shit. A Subaru, with a plastic bubble attached to the top like a giant fanny pack, rolls to a stop in the traffic. Its passenger side window rolls down.
You need a ride?
Inside, a nice-looking woman checks her rearview mirror, then smiles at me. Her son, presumably, sits in the back seat, engrossed in some handheld video game.
Traffic's starting to move, hun, she says. In or out?
I open the passenger door and hop in. Thanks.
No problem.
She lets her foot off the brake and creeps slowly through the heavy traffic. We pass a derelict white building on the right. Off-white, really. The offest white there ever was.
You traveling for Labor Day? She asks.
I set my JanSport between my feet. Something like that.
You and everybody else.
She points through the windshield. Long weekends, people really come out of the woodwork, you know? I nod politely. From the back seat, her kid grunts, mutters something about how dying is lame. I'll assume he means a video game death.
So, she says, where are you from?
Cleveland, I answer, wondering how many questions this ride is going to cost. I reach into my pocket for the comfort of my war paint.
Nice town! We love Cleveland, don't we, Charles?
She continues talking, but I'm no longer listening. I am no longer anything at all.
The lipstick is gone. To an Indians game for his father's birthday, didn't you, Charles?
I reach down, unzip my bag, the box, the coffee can, a water bottle, shirts and socks. No lipstick.
Pull over, I mutter. I'm sorry?
Where did I see it last? I definitely had it when I left the bus. I had it when that stupid girl offered me cigarettes. I had it in my hands when I fell asleep.
Can you pull over, please? I have to get out.
Are you sure?
Let it be under the bridge.
Yes, I'm sure. Pull over.
The woman, forever nameless, pulls the Subaru to the side of the highway. I grab my bag, give a half-hearted thanks, and hoof it back to the bridge.
Please let it be there.
Due to the crawling traffic, we'd only gone about 100 yards or so. I arrive under the bridge breathless and search every square inch near the spot where I'd fallen asleep. To make up for my lack of vision, I quadruple-check, but it's no use. The lipstick isn't here. I stare at the ground, unable to move, unable to think, just thoroughly not able. And just as this reality sets in, of arriving at my mother's sickbed without one of my primary reasons, I see it. Not the lipstick. Kneeling, I rub the cracks in the pavement. The nose, the tail, the feet. Such a specific shape, my pavement rabbit.
Do you like shiny things? I have lots of shiny there.
I see an image on the horizon. Every step is intentional, quick-footed, as if it's late for something. I put my head down and sprint.
Do you like the Cubs?
Asks Walt. All inquiries related to the lost lipstick have been stonewalled with questions like this. Do I like the color yellow? Do I like sausage? Do I like dinosaurs? It's a preference marathon, and I'm slowly wearing down.
I don't know, Walt. Sure.
Sports is a thing, and I recognize that, but it is not my thing. Football, basketball, soccer, and yes, hockey all seem beyond pointless. Baseball, however, I get. Or at least, I don't not get. Back before the breaking news, it was one of the few things Mom and Dad and I all enjoyed. Something about the narrative of the sport, I think, is what we found appealing. The unique personality of each player and team, the intricate strategies based on who's at bat, who's on base, and who's pitching, the minutiae, the inches, the history. Plus, it's relaxing. 3 hours a day on a well-manicured field? I guess my family idealized that kind of idle recreation, as we rarely encountered anything like it within our own home. I never had a favorite team, but I know enough about baseball to know that the Cubs have pretty much the worst luck of any team in all of professional sports. Like, in the history of history, no team has ever been as unlucky as the Chicago Cubs.
You want to go to a game?
Asks Walt, a look of pure excitement on his face.
We should eat first, but then we could go to a game if we can get tickets.
He raises his index finger in the air like he's had a profound idea.
We have to have tickets, though. Tickets.
As the hour passes, traffic thins to an occasional car or semi careening into the sinking sun. We follow in kind, on the margins of the highway, the oddest of couples.
So, Walt, I wouldn't be mad or anything, you know, if you took the lipstick. I just need it back. It's really important.
The shiny lipstick?
He says. I glance sideways at him, wondering if he knows he just gave himself away.
Yeah, Walt. It's got some shiny on it.
He nods.
No, I don't have it.
Just as I wonder what it would take to physically search the kid, he hops over the nearby guardrail and disappears into the adjacent woods.
This way, Mim!
Back under the bridge, for just a moment, the option to continue my trip sans war paint had been just that. An option. But no longer. The thought of moving on without it, when I know exactly where it is. Ahead, the pink sun becomes a dingy crimson, and soon, it will fade entirely. I sigh and turn back toward the shadowy woods. Curiouser and curiouser, I whisper. And with the daring temperament of Alice herself, I climb the guardrail and follow my white rabbit into the trees.
Chapter 17